Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants, and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome to episode 1466. We've got part two of our guest from yesterday, Mark Moss, with us to finish out that round. But before we get to that, I want to remind you, what do I need to remind you of? Well, we have our 1031 tax deferred exchange webinar on Friday and this weekend. And guess what I'm doing this weekend, by the way? I know, nobody does anything on the weekends anymore. The days are all becoming the same as we enter day 275 of quarantine. Just kidding on the 275. But it feels like that sometimes, doesn't it? It certainly does. It certainly does. You know, it's really interesting how the areas that are opening back up are experiencing such uneven results in terms of infections and cases and so forth. And when you look around the world too, the same with the very uneven reactions to the virus, right? You know, Brazil, very different than South Korea or Singapore or, you know, China, and then also very different than Sweden. And these things are not, I don't know, there's not a lot of consistency in the results, is there? You'll have some places that are sort of open liberally, okay, and they're not taking many precautions, and they're not getting very many infections. But others, like Brazil, that sort of, you know, gave coronavirus the finger, that was silly, now they're really paying for it. So why? This is just very uneven. One reason, I am sure, is density, the population density in a given area. So you can't even look country by country. You got to look city by city or really micro market, micro neighborhood, just like real estate. All real estate is local and all infections are local, right? So same rule applies there. It's really fascinating to watch all this stuff. And of course, at the same time, it's tragic. But we're going to see. I think it'll be interesting to see how history informs us more about what's going on now. You know, it's harder to see something when you're in the middle of it, right? And the same is true with trying to time the market, isn't it? So if you're trying to time the real estate market, it's a fool's errand, okay? Good luck with that one. Good luck with that. You know, you're probably going to be wrong. And if you are right, you're only going to be right a small part of the time. And if you are right, you're going to miss the opportunity that you would have had to earn that return earlier, right? If you didn't invest, or you might miss the opportunity on the flip side. It's just very hard to do. So just the prudent thing is to just do things that make good sense, where the numbers make sense, where you follow commandment number 5, thou shalt not gamble, be a prudent, conservative investor. You know, follow my strategy and you'll be okay. It's hard to go wrong following my 10 commandments, all 22 of them. Yes, there are 22 of the 10 commandments now. You know what commandment number 22 is, by the way, right? Thou shalt invest in low density environments. Yes. We were doing that anyway for the past 16 years, but I never had a commandment about it. So, hey, I made one just recently, a couple months ago. Okay, so I got to tell you something to find out if a property makes sense the day you buy it, which is part of commandment number 5 that I was just talking about. We would normally say that the first metric is that rule of thumb. It doesn't tell you everything, but it tells you something. It's the simple metric. It's the really easy one. Even a Democrat could figure it out. And that is the RV ratio, the rent to value ratio. Yes, even the Democrats could figure that one out. I know. There you go. All right. Hey, I'm just kidding. There's a lot of smart Democrats. But yeah, whatever. So when you have the RV ratio, right? I originally started talking about this back in 2003, but I didn't really get into the full-time investment business until 2004, when I was selling my traditional real estate company to Coldwell Banker at that time. And that deal took about a year to negotiate. And I started teaching people that you've got to evaluate these markets. You've got to buy investments that make sense from day one. And I was, you know, when I was first doing this, I was doing it at my office meetings for my traditional real estate company. So I had like 65 employees, right? Or, well, employees and contractors, I should say, but depends how you look at them. The shorthand staff. How's that? My staff consisted of 65 people when I sold that company. Took about a year to do the deal. But before I got into the investment business as a full-time occupation, like I'm in now, I started teaching people about the RV ratio in 2003, and that was the rent-to-value ratio. Now, there were various other ways to calculate the RV ratio. Mine was just the simple way. It was the look at the price you pay for the property and look at the rental income and do that ratio. And back then, I said that 0.5% was too low. Yeah, that would be dumb. You shouldn't buy that property. If it was 0.5, way too low. And that was sort of the typical thing in California. You'd get a 0.5 RV ratio. So a $600,000 property might rent for $3,000 a month. Probably it would even rent for a little less, maybe $2,500 to $2,800 a month. And by the way, check those ratios now. They're still pretty close 17 years later. Isn't that interesting? Because the world operates on ratios. Okay, numbers just don't give you enough information. What gives you good information is a ratio. Why is a ratio so important? Because a ratio just intrinsically asks the Jason Hartman question, compared to what, right? Compared to what? And that's pretty much everything in life is a compared to what question. We all make choices on a compared to what basis. Oh, hey, speaking of compared to what, I was going to tell you what I'm doing this weekend. Well, I'm doing a few things, but one of the things I was going to tell you that's interesting about the current world in which we live is I've been looking at new cars from my computer screen. Haven't gone to look at any in a while. And so I'm thinking about getting a new car, and, you know, I hardly ever drive at all. I've been thinking about getting a car subscription, a CAS, like SAS. You know, SAS is capital S, small a, capital S, software as a service, right? And that's the way we mostly use software nowadays in the cloud, software as a service, SaaS. Well, CAS is car as a service. I might have made that up. I'm not sure I've heard or read that anywhere. But anyway, subscription cars, right? You can do this. A lot of the auto manufacturers, Porsche, Volvo, Mercedes, you know, I'm sure some cheaper cars too have a CAS program. But they don't seem like they're really that good a deal. It just seems like kind of a warmed over car lease. So I don't know. I'll continue to investigate. But anyway, I've been looking at Consumer Reports. Great company, by the way. You know me. Listen, I am a consumer advocate. I love consumer advocacy. When I was a kid, I used to watch a show by a guy named David Horowitz. And David Horowitz was my first introduction as a kid. I don't know, when did I discover him? Maybe when I was 8 years old. And he used to have the show called Fight Back. Fight Back, David Horowitz, right? And he would go and expose all these scam artists and these crooks and these ripoff people. And, you know, he was on the news on, I think, Channel 7, ABC in Los Angeles, California, where I grew up. It was great. I loved watching David Horowitz because I felt like he was, you know, he was a fighter for the people, a fighter for the underdog. And I just loved it. And, you know, that's shaped a lot of my career today. You know, I'm a consumer advocate. I go and take these crooks to task and, you know, I'll get into litigation with them. And, you know, a lot of litigation doesn't make much economic sense, but, you know, I feel it's kind of a duty. You know, you got to do it to do the right thing. Because remember, when you don't stand up to a person who rips you off, if someone cheats you in a deal and they get away with it and you let them get away with it. You know, most people just say, it's not worth it. I'm not going to bother. I got to preserve my peace of mind. Well, I say BS. That's bogus. If you have resources, okay, now I'm not saying the poor immigrant with no money and no resources and no connections needs to do this stuff. But someone who has resources has an obligation to their fellow man to fix the problems of society, to write their congressperson, to write their senator, to stand up to the con artist, the thief, the bully, okay? They have a duty to do that. And, you know, most of you listening, frankly, I know most of you, and you have resources, okay? Because I know my audience. So, you know, don't be the person who says, don't bother. You know, I get the idea. Look, folks, we've all heard the saying, you got to pick your battles. That's true. You do have to pick your battles. But you should pick your battles a little more, well, how do I say this? If you have resources, if you have some wealth, if you have some resources, knowledge, connections, whatever resources you have, I say that you should pick your battles less intelligently. How do you like that one? Less intelligently. If you don't have resources, you have to conserve what little resources you have, right? So you really do have to pick your battles and you have to try to avoid all battles, right? But if you have resources, you owe it to the greater good to use those resources to make sure that that bully, con artist, thief, scumbag does not take advantage of the next person who comes along. Because believe me, if you let them get away with it, what are they going to do the next time? They're going to take advantage of the next person. And they've probably been doing it for years because they're scum. Okay, now, hey, hopefully there's a special place in hell for these people. But you got to use your resources to do something for the greater good. This is basically the definition of charity work, of volunteerism. So, you know, if you got to donate some money to go and fight a battle to save the next 25 people that are going to come along or the next 1,000 people that are going to get ripped off by this crook you run into and encounter in your life, then do it. You know, what are we here for, people? What are we here for? If we have resources, if we're successful, if we have brains, if we have money, we got to do something for the greater good. That's the point of life. I slept and dreamt that life was joy. I woke and saw that life was duty. I acted, and behold, duty was joy. Now, enough of my tangent, because that's, I don't know where we got off on that. That was completely different than what I started with. Here's what I started with. I tell you, commandment number 5. Okay, so thou shalt not gamble. Now, I want to revise the rent-to-value ratio. So back in 2003, I told everybody 1% rent-to-value ratio was ideal. 0.7% was good enough if everything else was really good and the property was good and, you know, all the other, the path of progress and everything looked good, right? 0.7 was, you know, good enough to consider the deal. And 0.5, no way. Don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. Don't buy that property. It doesn't make sense. You're a gambler if you buy that because most people are buying it on speculation, hoping that something great will happen called appreciation. Then when it doesn't come, they're devastated. They've lost their money. But here's the thing. Back in 2003, now let me look at the chart I'm pulling up here, folks. In 2003, let's look at the mortgage rates in 2003. Here they are. Here they are. Okay, so if you would have taken out a mortgage, now these are owner-occupied rates, so understand that investor rates are not widely charted very well, okay? And they're a little higher, maybe quarter point higher. But in the middle of 2003, you would have paid right around 5.6 to 6.25% on a mortgage rate, okay? Now, you would pay, today, you would pay 3.31. In fact, one of our listeners, Charles, yeah, Charles, I'm talking to you. You just got this killer refi. You ready for this, folks? You're probably not going to get this deal. So I'm gonna bum you out a little bit. You're going to be a little envious of Charles. Many of you have met Charles. He's been to, you know, Prophets in Paradise and Meet the Masters, our events, our conferences. And he got, it's unbelievable, 2.99%, 2.99% on his own home with he and his wife and kids, 30-year fixed rate. Wow, I'm jealous, Charles. Congratulations, high five, virtual high five, you scored. But right now, the published rate is 3.31%. So the interest rate is half of what it was when I originally quoted those rent-to-value ratios. So now, look, the rent-to-value ratio just ain't that meaningful like it used to be. It's still a good ratio, but the question is, you got to apply some new numbers to it. Because that, you know, you can have a lower rent-to-value ratio today because your debt is so cheap, it's half price. Your debt is half price. Well, almost. It's not quite half price, okay? But it's almost half price of what it was when yours truly originally started talking about those rent-to-value ratios 17 years ago. And the rent-to-value ratio, just like the crap rate, the cap rate, does not take into account the cost of the debt. And the debt is so cheap, you're literally getting paid to borrow. So don't freak out about rent-to-value ratios anymore. You can be much more lax about them than you used to be. If you're expecting the 1% rule, yeah, you might get it in some lower end, you know, C-class type properties, maybe even a little better if you get lucky. But you don't need it. It doesn't need to be that good anymore. The investment can still be awesome because the mortgage is so cheap that the RV ratio, the rent-to-value ratio, has to be revised, okay? It has to be, to some extent, ignored. You look at the pro forma, and you can still see that your cash on, you don't even need to look at a pro forma, you can just do the math yourself. You can just calculate your cash on cash return. Go to jasonhartman.com, watch the free video on the front page of jasonhartman.com, and you can learn more about that. But yeah, it's phenomenal, okay? So rent-to-value ratio, it's out the window, okay? It just isn't the same world, okay? So it's not as important. It ain't what it used to be, okay? It ain't what it used to be. All right, so the 1031 Tax Deferred Exchange webinar, let me give you the link for that. Then let's get to our guest. It's bit.ly/1031profit, all lowercase. bit.ly, you know, it's a bit.ly link, the shortened link, /1031, that's the IRS code, 1031 for 1031 exchange, profit, 1031 profit, bit.ly/1031profit. If you forget that, it's in the show notes at jasonhartman.com, and we will see you there Friday and on the weekend for that webinar, and you can learn about income property being the most tax-favored asset class in America. Here is part two of Mark Moss. Hey, talk to us a little bit about cryptocurrencies, if you will. I haven't talked about that much on the show lately, and I used to talk about it a lot, you know, and this is something that I say to my listeners, Mark, I would love to be wrong about this. You know, I'm not a Bitcoin bull, but I'd love to be wrong. I really would. I'd love nothing more than to see a decentralized, like democratized currency. I just think that the Fed and the government, they're just too powerful. You know, and other central banks. And I kind of view it as that, like, the chief product of any government is literally their currency. Like, yeah. The dollar is the product they produce, right? Tesla makes cars, you know, other companies make widgets. Well, governments make currency, right? That's their product.
So a couple things I'd say about that. One, you mentioned earlier that fiat means it's like government mandated, right?
Right.
Well, fiat means it's fake money. And, yep. and the thing is that people think that the government has the military and they're going to force people to use the dollar, but that's mm-hmm. not how it works. Mm-hmm. there has to be trust. Without trust, nobody will use it. That's why in Venezuela right now, it's lined with paper dollars and nobody will even bother to pick them up.
Right.
Nobody cares. It doesn't matter how much the government mandates you to use it. If nobody wants it, nobody wants it. And that's just the end of the story. Zimbabwe, we can talk about this all day. Zimbabwe has $100 trillion banknotes.
Yeah.
And so when there's no trust, no one's going to use it. I don't care how big the military is. So that being said, the government has a monopoly on it because they did this sly, tricky thing where all dollars were backed by gold. In 1971, they removed that, but the dollar didn't really change. And most people don't really even understand what happened there. And that's all fine and good as long as things continue to work as they are. But at some point that may fail. But what I would also do is I would roll things back a little bit. And I would say, like, if you looked at, you know, maybe in the 1400s, 1500s, really like the Catholic Church and the government were like together as one, right? And the people weren't allowed to read the Bible. And then we got the printing press and the Bibles were mass produced, and eventually the information got spread. So the information, the point that I want to make is information was centralized.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to go to the church. You had to go to the Catholic Church to get the information, and they told mm-hmm. you what they wanted you to know. It wasn't available for you to think on your own.
Mm-hmm.
Once the printing press came out, it decentralized the information access to the Bible, and the Catholic Church lost the stranglehold, and eventually we got the separation of church and state.
Mm-hmm. Today, things become democratized.
Today, right. As you're saying, there's a monopoly, centralization of money, of value. And the government holds the monopoly on that, as you're saying, and you're accurate in saying that. But things can become decentralized. And so eventually, I believe we're on a very short path to seeing a separation of money and state. And I believe mm-hmm. we need to go. And so really, if you look at – did you have a question about that?
Well, yeah. Look, at every law and every government mandate comes down to being at the wrong end of the point of a gun. You know, that's the bottom line. You know, if you don't pay your taxes, first you'll get some letters. Then, you know, you'll get some phone calls. Then you'll get, police battering down your door and coming in and putting you in a cage, right? So that's the result of any law, right? So, you know, I look at it like, you know, cocaine, right? It's an illegal drug, but it has a market and a value, and people do trade in it as they trade in other illegal substances, but not many. You know, it's never going to be a big thing. It's never going to compete with the dollar because it's illegal.
You haven't seen the cartels and the hundred billion dollars they have then.
they got a lot, but compared to the GDP of the U.S. economy, it's a drop in the bucket, right? But yeah, it's a lot for Pablo Escobar, right? You know, sure. Or whatever, right?
Well, what I'd say to that, a couple things I'll say to that first is that one, it doesn't have to be necessarily, it depends on what you consider a success. And I guess it depends on what we're trying to talk about here. Meaning, first of all, like the gold market is $10 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
And not everybody uses gold. Most people don't even own gold.
Good point.
But yet it's $10 trillion. The offshore banking sector is about $40 trillion. Not everybody has offshore bank accounts. That's not even the standard, but yet it's $40 trillion. Mm-hmm. So could Bitcoin capture a little bit of that offshore banking? Could it capture a little bit of the gold market? If so, it could easily get to $5-10 trillion, which puts it at a couple $100,000 per Bitcoin. And that's without.
Well, that's an interesting point. Yeah, that's an interesting point. Do you know the size that like the market cap of Bitcoin now that's available Bitcoins? Because there's only like 2 million left or something, right?
The market cap as of today is...
It changes radically as we know.
$163 billion.
Okay, so it's tiny.
So I have a video on my channel how Bitcoin gets to $100,000. Mm-hmm. And basically $100,000 per coin. And it's simple. Like all it has to do is capture 2 or 3% of the gold market, 2 or 3% mm-hmm. of the offshore banking sector. And mm-hmm. like it can be there. And like offshore banking is not mainstream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it depends. Like, are we talking about like, will it go from, you know, $10,000 to $100,000, or will it become the reserve currency of the world? Those are different mm-hmm. conversations, of course.
Right.
I believe so. As an investor, I believe it's the single best investment we have today. I think there's a very probable chance. So we think about things in probabilities. I think there's a very probable chance we could see it get to $100,000, which is from $10,000 to $100,000 is an amazing gain. Or it could lose 100%. So you could lose 100%, or you have an upside of 1,000%. Those are odds I like.
And that equation is a pretty good equation. You're right. And by the way, we should tell the audience, because they don't know you yet, you know, you're a real estate guy. Like, you love real estate investing and you talk about it a lot. And, you know, this is something you do with a small portion of your portfolio for that possible home run swing, right?
Yeah. I mean, I also invest into gold and I also invest into stocks and all that. So, but all of that is put together into, like I said, my growth allocation. And then when I take profits from there, I take those profits and I put them over into cash flow and into real estate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's a quote that I can't remember who said it. And I have somebody, I think it was F.A. Hayek, who's one of the great Austrian economics of our time.
Yeah.
And he said that there shall never be a sound money again until it is taken from the hands of the government. But it can't be done by force, but rather through a sly roundabout way that they don't know until it's too late.
Which is basically, interestingly, what they've been doing to us for years through inflation, the sly roundabout way to destroy our wealth. Yeah.
And so Bitcoin fits that narrative perfectly because it's this sly roundabout way. If the government, the Fed, whoever you want to say, would have seen what was going on 10 years ago, they would have stopped it. Mm-hmm. At this point, it's too big. It's too prevalent. So I'm not saying that all the governments of the world can't come together and make it illegal and they'll kill you if they catch you with it. And that would definitely limit the ability. I'm not saying that won't happen. There's a chance that could happen. There is a chance. But there's also a chance that doesn't happen, right? And when you look at it, so like Representative Brad Sherman from California, another great Californian guy, he spoke to the Senate committee and said, we need to outlaw cryptocurrency because it undermines our monopoly on money. And what it does as the US is it takes away our ability to slap sanctions on countries like Iran.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he said. But Iran was sitting there listening going, oh, really? Well, then I think we should use it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so all of a sudden now the fact that the US would want to make it illegal makes other countries want to adopt it. And what it creates game theory.
Mm-hmm.
And so now the US, I'm not saying they are, but the US makes it illegal. And then all of a sudden they go lives in that free part of the world. So that's one thing. The other thing that I would say is that we know that that policy is set by lobbying, right? The people lobby the government and they get their way with the government, right?
Right.
And I would say that I don't know who's bigger, but probably the two biggest lobby are pharma and finance.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So finance is definitely one of the biggest lobby arms in there. And we know that Goldman Sachs, Fidelity, TD Ameritrade, NYSE, BACT, all these companies have spent collectively billions of dollars to start building out Bitcoin products. And so they're not going to be happy to see the government change policy and make that illegal after they've already spent billions of dollars to bring those products in. I would bet they're going to spend a lot of money lobbying to keep that active so they can make that money.
Mm-hmm. How do you recommend buying Bitcoin?
How do I recommend buying it?
Yeah. I mean, on like the common exchanges, or do you recommend doing it some other way? Or
I mean, the easiest way, maybe not the most ideal way, but the easiest way is go to Coinbase.com, set up an account. I mean, they're a US-based company, fully legit, fully transparent. Yeah. You link up your account and you just click buy and it just buys it. Jack Dorsey from Twitter has a company called Square, and there's a company and they have what's called the Cash App. And then you can just download this Cash App on your phone and it's kind of like a banking app. And I can request money, send money, kind of like a Venmo kind of type deal. Mm-hmm. And I can buy Bitcoin right in the Cash App.
Okay. Got it. So he's selling it too. That's interesting. And tell us about the halving that just happened.
Yeah. So I want to tell you about the halving, but I want to tell you just back to, well, let's talk about the halving first. So, basically what happened, and this is a very interesting thing, and I actually have a video dropping on my YouTube channel here in 1 minute, talking about the halving. So if anybody wants to know more, they can go watch that on the channel. But basically what happens is it's very interesting. So the Bitcoin was created as a direct response to the 2008 great financial crash. So in the very first line of code, the programmer, Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever he is, but the programmer wrote a line in the code and he quoted the headline of a newspaper article. The chancellor is on the brink of a second bailout. And it was in response to this endless money printing that Bitcoin was created. And Bitcoin was created to be deflationary. So we talk about money and there's just no end to how much they make. And of course, the more they make, the less it's worth. The dollar's lost 98% of its purchasing power over the last 100 years. Well, Bitcoin was created as a response to that, and it's made deflationary. It has a hard cap, never be more than 21 million Bitcoin ever. And what happens is over time, they're released. So and there's a new block. You've heard blockchain. So as the transactions gets processed, it's block by block by block, and it gets added every 10 minutes, a new block. And every 10 minutes, a new block releases Bitcoins into the system. And if you have – if you buy a computer and you hook into the network, which is permissionless, everybody's able to do this. Anyone can hook a computer in and start helping the network with security. If you participate in that, when coins are released, you get a share of that, depending on how much share you're putting in on work. Now, in the beginning, it was 50 coins, 50 Bitcoin every block, every 10 minutes. But what happens is that that schedule goes down. Every 4 years, it gets cut in half. So then it was 25 Bitcoins every 10 minutes. Right now, we've been 12.5 Bitcoin every 10 minutes. And as of yesterday, it became 6.25 Bitcoin every 10 minutes. And yeah. So back to what I said about supply and demand, right? Things are super simple. Right now, as of yet before yesterday, we were creating 1,800 new Bitcoin were created every single day. 1,800 Bitcoin. It's about at today's price, roughly $16 million, right? So the market, the demand and the supply is 1,800 new Bitcoin every day. The demand is absorbing that, and the price is stable with that supply and demand. If the demand stays the same, but you cut the supply in half, what happens? The price should go up.
Right. Should. Yeah.
So that's the big deal with the halving. So we're on this supply schedule, this fixed supply schedule. Every 4 years, the amount, the inflation, right, you can call it the inflation of Bitcoin gets cut in half every 4 years. And basically all the way, we have about 120 more years until it runs out and we max out the 21 million Bitcoin and there's no more.
So Mark, I know we got to wrap it up here, but this is fascinating. And, you know, one more thing I hear from the skeptics is they'll say, well, okay, Bitcoin is limited. You got like 21 million allowed or something like that, right? But the market for cryptocurrency in general is totally unlimited. I mean, you've got all these others out there, right? Ethereum and a zillion others. What do you say to that? Like, is it just a cryptocurrency thing, or is it all about Bitcoin?
In my mind, it's all about Bitcoin. And what I would say to that is you have one Mona Lisa mm-hmm. that's worth a lot of money. You have two paintings right behind you. Do those mm-hmm. two paintings diminish the value of Mona Lisa?
No, they don't.
They don't. There's thousands of paintings. There's millions of paintings in the world. Right. Sure. Do those millions of paintings diminish the value of the Mona Lisa?
Yeah.
No, right. They don't. And the reason why is because Mona Lisa has characteristics that are unique to the Mona Lisa. Mm-hmm. And Bitcoin has characteristics that are unique to Bitcoin that no one else has. No one mm-hmm. else can do. No one else, no other coin, no other cryptocurrency could ever replicate or duplicate. Well, I don't want to say ever, but have not so far been mm-hmm. able to, and I would almost say never, probably never could ever duplicate what Bitcoin has. And so what does Bitcoin have? It has immutability. It has scarcity and it has censorship resistant. And this is the big thing, right? So you've seen in Weimar Republic, you've seen in Cyprus in 2015, Australia has bail-in laws. The government goes broke. They just take your money. They seize gold. The U.S. seized gold in 1933, right? So the government just takes your money when they want it. Bitcoin is censorship resistant. Nobody can seize it, steal it. Nobody can manipulate it, prevent it. We saw like in WikiLeaks, we saw Julian Assange was holed up and people were sending him money. And then the government just said, nope, you can't send him money anymore. So people started sending him Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So Bitcoin is freedom. Bitcoin is sovereignty. If I hold Bitcoin, nobody can steal it. Nobody can seize it. Nobody can manipulate it. Nobody can inflate it away. Like those dollars in your bank account, the government's inflating them away, or they could take them out of your bank if they wanted, either way, right? Yeah. But nobody can seize it. And in addition, if I want to pay you for something with dollars through PayPal, Venmo, wire transfer, there's 50 people in line that could stop that transaction. Mm-hmm. But Bitcoin is peer-to-peer. If I want to pay you, nobody can stop it, block it, or prevent it. It's mm-hmm. freedom. It's sovereignty. And I believe that freedom and sovereignty will always win.
Yeah, and that's a really good libertarian view. I like it. I guess the only way they could stop it is they could somehow block the packets on the internet. Like, you know, they can block voice packets, right? Because they're different than other bits and bytes, you know.
Technically, yeah. No, right? So people are already doing Bitcoin transactions over ham radios. Mm-hmm. They're doing them through there's a new thing called mesh networks. Mm-hmm. And so it's getting really, really big, where there's a new sector called dissident tech. And so as mm-hmm. governments become more tyrannical, we're seeing dissident, for example, that we see it in New York as well, but there's called mesh networks, and basically right. they're little mini you know what that is,
like
little
yeah mini yeah antenna. they use multiple radio waves. They'll use yeah. your Bluetooth, your Wi-Fi, and the cellular Bluetooth. Yeah, right.
Exactly. Yeah. So they're transferring Bitcoin on mesh networks. Yeah, they're transferring okay. Bitcoin on ham radios. And so they have satellites up. So there's satellites up. If the ISP takes internet down, you have the satellites up. So you're right. I mean, there could be this cat and mouse. There's all these what ifs, right? And they're all, and we have to recognize those. We don't want to ignore them, but we want to assign them probabilities. Is that probable that I hear it all the time on my channel. What if the whole internet goes down? And I'm like, yeah. if you think there's a world with no internet, like
I know.
we have bigger problems. So I mean, yeah. is right. that probable? I guess, but I give it such a small yeah, percentage right. of prop, right? So you have Fair to look enough. At all these things. And yeah. I will give you though that money is power, and the Fed, the central banks, whoever you want to call it, control the world with the money, and yeah. they do not want to lose control of that. Yeah. And they will yeah. throw every tool in their arsenal at this.
Right.
And so it's going to be a battle, and I'll give you that.
Yeah, and I think they'll come along with their own cryptocurrency, their own digital dollar, you know, at some point. That's going to happen but the problem is, when that happens, there will be zero financial privacy. I mean, they will know our every move. I mean, one of the, you know, ultimate forms of freedom is the ability to trade without Big Brother watching you, you know, to buy what you want. Can you imagine in a really ugly dystopian 1984-ish world where, you know, every time you make a purchase on the internet or something, the government questions, well, what was that for? It's like posting something on Facebook that they consider questionable, and they'll hide it or ghost it, or, you know, or they yeah. don't agree with the politics. I mean, it's absolutely scary. Yeah.
It's even worse. So like those government cryptocurrencies, that it's programmable money. So right. they can program it. So for yeah. example, if you're receiving government assistance, for example, when they transfer that money, they can program that money where you can only spend it on these certain things.
Right.
It can't be on these things. If you don't spend it within a certain time, it automatically comes back to them. Mm-hmm. So like it can be programmed any way they want before they even give it to you.
Yeah. Yeah. And that will create all sorts of black markets.
But what I would just say is the overarching theme is what I started with, is it all always has to come down to trust. And so no government force, and they threaten you with the barrel of a gun. I understand that, but no amount of force can make you use something when humans don't want to trade for it. So when in Venezuela, they go to buy that bread with those dollars, and they say, I don't want those dollars, but I will take water. I'll take batteries.
Yeah,
I'll
right.
take fruit, right? I don't want those Venezuelan dollars. And so at the end of the day, there's always going to be free will. There's always going to be free trade, and no amount of force can affect that, I don't think.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, very good. Because, you know, I remember when I was in Romania, our guide was a high level person under the, you know, Ceausescu communist regime. Right. And she was a media reporter. And so she got to live a much nicer life than other people did. But of course, she had to toe the state line, which was completely bogus. And she talked about how they would ration everything. And maybe one or two times a year, the country would get, you ready for this? Chocolate. And the whole country would be like in heaven. They'd be stoned on chocolate because they got chocolate, right? And, you know, she said that they would dole out shoes. There would be a certain time when the government would announce that, hey, we've got shoes, and you can go get shoes based on, you know, whatever your name is, or I don't know how they did it. But people would wait in line to get a pair of shoes, Mark, for, you know, 24, 36 hours, and they'd get their place, and they'd go into the place to get their free communist shoes, and they wouldn't have their size. And I said, well, what did you do? Well, we had to develop our own market and trade them behind the scenes, because we had to get what fit properly, right? And that's exactly what you're saying. People always develop their own gray or black markets for everything. So that's true. Capitalism is a very natural thing, isn't it?
It is.
It's good. Hey, give out your website. This has been great talking to you. Give out your website. Tell people where they can find out more.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I put out content a couple times a week on YouTube. Just search Mark Moss. You'll find it there. Like I said, I just dropped a video as it released right now on this whole Bitcoin halving. So if you want to know more about that, I have a whole video about that. I talk about all these different topics that we've kind of covered on this show. So if you like any of those topics, making money, investing money, and having success in life, then check out the channel. It's the best place to see me.
We love it. Hey, Mark, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yep. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own. And if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.